The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
And we've made it to another Friday. Yes. I get excited because, you know, we take pleasure in small miracles around here. Welcome to the end of another week. I'm Nicole Sandler, coming to you live at NicoleSandler.com, Facebook Live, Periscope, still not back on YouTube. Although, I was able to get one of the bogus copyright strikes against me done away with. Now I'm working on the other one, which is turning out to be a bit more difficult. But I'm working on it because, you know, what else have I got to do? So here we are. It's another week, another day, another weird hearing on Capitol Hill. Now, why am I hearing something coming back? Where is it coming from? I don't know. I gotta figure out where I've got some volume up ever so slightly. Okay, I think I got rid of it. Anyway, little technical things, you know. So we have an interesting show on tap for you today. The ACLU has been in existence now for 100 years. It was officially formed in 1920. Although its predecessor was around for 5 years before that, but the ACLU, as the organization that stands today, was formed in 1920. And it was formed against the backdrop of a kind of a racist president in Woodrow Wilson and some racial strife. I mean, it sounds really familiar because a lot of things are like all just a little bit of history repeating, which, by the way, is a great song by the Propellerheads featuring Shirley Bassey that I can't play for you because I'll get hit with another copyright strike. So go look it up on YouTube or whatever music streaming service you use, and you can thank me later because it's really good. But anyway, yeah, here we are today. What was the hearing though? Oh, today, Dr. Fauci was in the hot seat in Congress, and Jim Jordan once again proved himself to be an asshole. Jim Jordan, congressman from Ohio, who I wonder why he's still there, because it is now widely known that Jim Jordan, spelled with a G-Y-M, in case you were wondering, for good reason, because back when he was an assistant coach at, I believe it was Ohio State University. It might have been University of Ohio. So don't, I could be wrong on that one. But one of those Ohio State universities. He was an assistant wrestling coach. And Jim Jordan had firsthand knowledge that the coach was sexually abusing the young men on the team. And Jim Jordan did nothing. Nope, I'm wrong. He didn't do nothing. He looked the other way. Jim Jordan should be arrested for aiding and abetting a predator and a rapist. I mean, for a lot of things. But instead, he sits there with his holier-than-thou attitude, just being a real jerk. So he was a jerk today to Dr. Fauci. I didn't even pull the audio of that because it made me so angry. But I did pull a little bit of audio. This is Jim Jordan yesterday in the hearing where they were questioning the heads of the four tech giants, the heads of Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, Jeff Bezos of Amazon. What else? Facebook, Amazon, Google, the guy from Google, whose name I can't remember, because he's actually the parent, the CEO of the parent company, Alphabet. And what was the fourth one? It wasn't Twitter. It was Facebook, Google. I'm drawing a blank now. The fourth one, and I'm probably going to kick myself. Bezos, Zuckerberg, the Google guy. And I'm drawing a blank, but it'll come to me when I'm not thinking of it. But here's a little bit of just to show you what an asshole Jim Jordan is. This was at the end of his going off the rails. He just went off on these people. And then it was the end of his time for questioning. So then the next 5 minutes went to a Democrat, and her name was Tim Apple. Thank you. Tim Apple of Apple. Tim Cook of Apple. That's who it was. I forget Apple because I'm not an Apple person. I really have a deep-seated hatred of Macs, of Apple as a corporation. Just saying. Thank you. And now Hillary Keyes in the chat room saying Apple. Anyway, so Jim Jordan goes off on them. Oh, you censor the Republicans. You're all liberal libtards or whatever nonsense he was spewing. So then his 5 minutes was up. And the next 5 minutes went to the Democrat, I believe it was Mary Kay Scanlon or Mary Gay Scanlon or something like that, who had a little bit of a snarky comment to make. And then Jim Jordan just went off. So here was some excitement from yesterday at the House Judiciary Committee subcommittee on tech nonsense.
Can you give us two assurances? One, you're
this
not going to
Jordan
tailor your features, configure your platform in a way to help Joe Biden. And second, that you're not going to use your search engine to silence conservatives. Can you give us those two assurances today?
Congressman, on our search engine, conservatives have more access to information than ever before.
And we appreciate that. That wasn't the question. Can you assure us today you're not going to try to silence conservatives? And can you assure us today you're not going to try to configure your features as Ms. Murillo said you did for Clinton in 16?
Right. Sure,
can
they
you assure
did.
Us today you're not going to do the
Google
same
was
thing
in the
for
tank
Joe Biden
for,
in 2020
for Hillary?
You have my commitment. It's always been true, and we'll continue to conduct ourselves in a neutral way.
Appreciate it. Yield back.
Okay.
The chair now recognizes the gentlelady from Pennsylvania, Ms. Scanlon.
Ms. Scanlon.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'd like to redirect your attention to antitrust law rather than fringe conspiracy theories. Mr. Bezos, our investigation...
Uh-oh. Mr. Chairman, we have the email. There is no fringe...
Excuse me, it's not your time.
Jordan, you do not have the time. Please be respectful of your colleague.
Someone directly...
She controls
directly,
the time. Directly.
Put your mask on. Put your mask on.
Mr. Jordan.
Put your mask on, Jimmy Raskin.
Mr. Jordan. Jordan, Ms. Scanlon,
why would the Deputy Secretary of Treasury unmask Michael Flynn's name?
Oh, my God.
And what I want to know is, when someone comes after my motives for asking questions, I get a chance to respond.
The gentlelady is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bezos, our investigation uncovered documents that show that Amazon sometimes doesn't play fairly.
Amazon sometimes doesn't play fairly. So that was a little bit of a clusterfuck from yesterday. And all I can say after listening to that and watching him today is I have two words for Jim Jordan. And you can sing along. It's an all-purpose greeting for people like Jim Jordan, and I can't play it enough. All right. You know, I like to start the show each day before we get into the news with something funny because, you know, the news is going to frustrate you and make you angry. It does me anyway. I'm just projecting it on you. So usually I've been playing these funny song parodies. Today, it's not a song parody. A listener sent me this yesterday. And every time I think about it, I laugh. This is a TikTok video from a kid, obviously a teenager, who I believe is in Australia. But this is the perfect example of how the rest of the world looks at America these days. Remember, we used to be that shining city on a hill or a country on a mountaintop or whatever you want to call it. We used to be the envy of most of the rest of the civilized world. And now the rest of the world looks upon us with pity because of the orange idiot occupying the Oval Office. So that said, this is a kid, I think, from Australia. And it's quick. It goes by fast. So let me just share it with you. And just so you know, it's the same kid doing all the different nationalities, in case you're not watching on video. I will post the video on the blog with today's podcast, as I do every day, at NicoleSandler.com, followed by the date. So today's will be NicoleSandler.com/7-31-20, if you want to see the video. So with no further ado, here it is from TikTok, some kid explaining how the rest of the world views us. Oy.
Welcome to the COVID-19 update meeting. New Zealand, how are you going?
Pretty much back to normal, bro. We're sweet as.
Fair dinkum, good on you, mate. UK, how you doing?
Well, my good sir, we are the definition of fucked.
Well, at least you can admit it. Russia, how are you going?
Very shit, but we have vodka, so it is okay.
Well, mate, just stay away from us and you'll be good to go. Ireland, how are you going?
Yeah, pretty good. We're just looking for the pubs to reopen again.
It's good to see, mate. Well, we've got one state that's a little bit out of control at the moment, but after a lockdown, it should be all good to go. America.
Huh?
America?
2600.
2600? That's not too bad at all.
An hour?
2600 a fucking hour?
Oh dear.
And you guys think that I am bad guy?
You guys are fucked, eh?
I have rights. I ain't wearing a mask.
Welcome to the COVID-19 update meeting.
All right. Yeah, and then it just repeats. Fucked. I ain't wearing a mask. I guess he was a Karen in that video. All right, I'm going to play, because it was quick, I'm going to play one more. And this one's kind of, well, inside. But anybody who had a young child anytime in the last 20 years or so should be able to get this. There was a very popular show when my daughter was little called Dora the Explorer. I don't know if it's still on the air or not because, well, my daughter is now 21 and needless to say, we no longer watch Dora the Explorer, but we used to all the time. And so I saw this, I cracked up, and then I played it for her and she cracked up. So I know it's not just me. It's funny. If you're not familiar with Dora the Explorer, it's only 42 seconds, so deal with it. Here we go.
Can you help us?
Yeah.
Can you say
person, woman, man, camera, TV?
So it's person, woman, man, camera, TV.
Hooray!
Person, woman, man, camera, TV.
Again!
Person, woman, man, camera, TV.
One more time!
Person, woman, man, camera, TV.
We did it! Yay!
Because I'm cognitively there.
Because he's cognitively there. Oh, my goodness. All right. I don't know about you, but I'm ready for some news.
I read the news today. Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. And, oh, my goodness, there's a lot to go with. So we're doing it live today.
We'll do it live.
All right. Got
it. Do it live.
All right. Thank you, Bill.
I'll write it, and we'll do it live.
Okay. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Bill.
Sucks.
Yeah, I agree. All right. So let me tell you what's happening in the crazy world in which we find ourselves these days. Donald Trump's flash of fascism yesterday, in which he suggested the possibility of delaying the 2020 presidential election due to the coronavirus pandemic, was roundly excoriated by allies and foes alike. And today, this morning, the usually very Trump supportive Wall Street Journal editorial page made its position clear from the very first words. They wrote, quote, "Delaying the November 3rd elections is a dreadful idea. Only an act of Congress can change the date, established in 1845, and there is no chance it will do so now. Lincoln ran for re-election amid the destruction and displacement of the Civil War." The editorial then goes on to raise a few concerns about the country's ability to conduct an election during a pandemic, when so many more people will be sending in their ballots via mail, and when it's unlikely that the results of the election will be known on the same day that it occurs. But they're not making the same point that Donald Trump fails to make. They continued, quote, "This is not to suggest that the November election will be rigged, as Mr. Trump asserts. If he believes that, he should reconsider his participation and let someone run who isn't looking for an excuse to blame for defeat." Woo-hoo-hoo! You tell him, Murdoch group. Yeah, because the Wall Street Journal is owned by Rupert Murdoch. Donald Trump, or I want to call him Ronald for some reason, is not making a lot of friends on that one. So, you know, when the reaction to one of his harebrained schemes is excoriated roundly like this, he falls back on his old, "It was a joke. I was just kidding." And as I used to always say to my child when she was younger, a joke is supposed to be funny. Now, many of us believe that Trump's outrageous suggestion was merely another ploy to distract the media and the rest of us from the big news of the day. And that was the fact that the U.S. economy crashed by a record-shattering 32.9% in the last quarter. It's the biggest drop ever recorded. And in fact, if you're watching on YouTube, on Facebook Live or Periscope, fuck you, YouTube. You'll see I put a graphic. This is from the front page of today's Washington Post. And the headline reads, U.S. economy contracts at record rate. And they have a chart, a bikini graph on there. And it shows all the way to the right the drop that we learned about yesterday from the second quarter of 2020. And it is far longer. Reaches way down below even that reached in, the 1920s and 30s with the Great Depression. Obviously, Donald Trump wanted to get everyone not talking about that. So he floats some harebrained, stupid, stable genius idea to postpone the elections, knowing that it's going to get people like you and me crazy. Because that's what they call owning the libs or something like that. Don't fall for it. I mean, here's my problem with this kind of stuff. And it's every day. It's Donald Trump with his tweets. It's all the things that if it were any other president, any other administration, any other time in American history, the world would be freaking out over. I mean, you've got a president going, promoting a drug. That has been proven by the medical experts to be ineffective in combating the biggest health threat to the world today. And they'd be all over that. But we have to look on it as a distraction, that he's doing these things to take our attention away from the bigger issues like fascism, like he's pulling the troops out of Germany. Not because of any strategic reason, because of a vendetta he's got against Angela Merkel, and because he doesn't like NATO, and because, he likes sucking Vladimir Putin's dick. It's the only thing I can think of, because this is what Putin wants. And yet, on top of that, we learned about this troop withdrawal from Germany after we found out that in the last phone conversation Trump had with Putin, he didn't even broach the subject of the U.S. intelligence reports saying that the Russians were paying a bounty to Taliban fighters for Americans killed in Afghanistan. Trump didn't even go there because he says it's fake news. So many people say it's fake news. Lots of people say it. And when he was asked who said it, lots of people, many people say it. So he believes many people instead of his own intelligence infrastructure. I talk about opposite world all the time. I've used this phrase for years, going back to the Bush administration, but even George W. Bush, as backwards as he was, didn't reside in the same gaslit opposite world where Trump apparently, I was going to say sleeps, but I don't think he sleeps.
Everything you thought you knew, you never knew it all. Sideways is straight ahead. Facts no longer matter. Reality is now fiction. There's a signpost up ahead. Your next stop, opposite world.
We are there. So there's other news going on, as there always is, and there's never enough. It didn't matter. If I lengthened this program to 2 hours and all I did was the news, I still wouldn't get through all of it. So I have to pick and choose what I share with you. I remind you, you can subscribe to my podcast, The Nicole Sandler Show, which is always free. I live on your donations, so it's all voluntary. And if you are a subscriber to the Nicole Sandler Show podcast, you also get What's News every day. And today's What's News extended version. It runs about 8 minutes, but we go a little more in depth in there. It runs throughout the day on the Progressive Voices Network, but the extended version you can get on my website at NicoleSandler.com or via podcast. One of the stories that I talk about there has to do with news out of Ferguson. Remember Ferguson, Missouri? You thought it was over, right? Well, it's not. And it's bad news today. St. Louis County's top prosecutor announced, well, late yesterday, that they would not charge the former police officer who fatally shot, who killed Michael Brown. They won't charge him. And this really could rip open old wounds amid a renewed and intense national reckoning about racial injustice and police brutality against people of color. It was almost 6 years ago that a grand jury declined to indict Darren Wilson. That's the name of this former cop who shot Michael Brown, then a 18-year-old young black man. This has been going on for almost 6 years. Civil rights leaders and Brown's mother had urged the county's first black prosecutor, Wesley Bell, who just took that office, to reopen the case. He took office last year, January of 2019, to no avail. So that happened. And meanwhile, in Portland, amid reports that the Department of Homeland Security was removing its mercenary forces from the downtown area, Oregon police have allegedly taken over protecting a federal courthouse in the city that's been the target of these protests for the last 60 days or so. So apparently the deal struck between the Democratic Governor Brown of Oregon and the Trump administration to draw down the number of alleged U.S. agents during these nightly protests came down to Oregon agreeing to have state and local officers step up their presence to protect the federal courthouse. Well, the unidentified alleged federal law enforcement agents have not yet left Portland. They're still there waiting to pounce to agitate peaceful protesters. They want to ratchet up the tension so that they can show violent videos and say, see those protesters, they're not protesters, they're violent, they're rioters. The protests in Portland had dropped down to maybe a couple of dozen people there a night until the administration sent in their unmarked thugs to infringe on these people's rights to protest. And of course, once the tear gas and rubber bullets started flying, protesters became more numerous. And we had moms and veterans all showing up to give a wall of protection to the peaceful protesters behind them and keep these thugs who are wearing military garb, camouflage gear, carrying weapons, throwing tear gas canisters, shooting rubber bullets and injuring protesters. But that's not enough. So Donald Trump decides to call them. Well, here's what he said yesterday about the protesters in Portland. And keep in mind, the majority of the protests have been peaceful. The violence, the tensions were ratcheted up once Trump sent in his thugs, who we still don't know who they are. They have no identification other than a generic police patch on their camouflage military uniforms, nothing that identifies their name, no badge number, and no mention of what agency they might be employed by. For all I know, these are Eric Prince Blackwater thugs. We don't know. And they are taking people off the streets and throwing them into unmarked vehicles with no arrest warrant, obviously no probable cause. And how does Trump characterize them?
So what happened is our people are staying there to see whether or not they could do it.
Yeah, he's saying they're not leaving Portland yet.
If they don't do it, we will send in the National Guard and we'll take care of it. And we're telling right now these protesters, and many should be arrested, because these are professional agitators.
They're what?
These are professional anarchists.
They're what?
These are people that hate our country.
What?
We're telling them right now that we're coming in very soon. The National Guard, a lot of people
Okay.
Very tough people.
Oh, shut up. Because, you know, I got a song for him, too. You see, this is the problem, and this is the main reason that I want to speak with our guest today, whose name is Ellis Coase, who wrote this book called, I want to get it right, it's called Democracy If We Can Keep It. Now, I know you're going, wait a minute, wasn't it A Republic If We Could Keep It? That's how it originally went, right? But the book is called Democracy If We Can Keep It. It's the ACLU's, the first 100 years of the ACLU. You know, that's why the ACLU is here, to protect our rights. I want to play for you a new ad from the, I think it's from the Lincoln Project. It's called We Will Vote. Again, Donald Trump, I think, is gaslighting all of us with all of it. But you don't know what you can take seriously. What he says that you need to, you know, take with a grain of salt. Oh, he's just trying to distract us. Or if he really means it, we don't know. I don't think he knows, because I don't think he has the brain capacity to figure any of it out. But here is the newest ad from the Lincoln Project called We Will Vote.
A failed president, the worst economy in U.S. history. More Americans have died in this four-month period than ever before. Donald Trump's response? Stop the election. He can't win. We voted during the wars. We voted in the Great Depression. We voted when civil unrest swept the country. Americans died for our right to vote. Americans marched for our right to vote. Americans were beaten and brutalized for our right to vote. Now a failed president faces defeat, with millions out of work and tens of thousands dying from his incompetence and neglect, threatening the very foundations of democracy. Donald Trump, here's the message. We will vote. We will defend America. We will throw you and your failed cronies out of office. The choice, America or Trump.
Huh. The Lincoln Project is responsible for the content of this advertising.
So there you go. That is the newest. Oh, hold on. I got to get past this. Wait. That's the newest ad from the Lincoln Project. And it hits right to what we're talking about. We are fighting for our rights. And I guess this is the perfect time to introduce our guest today. The timing, they say, is everything. And I guess the timing on this coincides with the 100th anniversary of the ACLU. So I'm thrilled to welcome to the show Ellis Coase. He is an author of about a dozen books on issues of national and international concerns, including the best-selling novel, The Rage of a Privileged Class, and the new book, Democracy If We Can Keep It, the ACLU's 100-Year Fight for Rights in America. Ellis, thank you so much for being here today. It's a pleasure to meet you.
My pleasure, Nicole. That's all totally mine.
It's an important subject. Obviously, the ACLU does such important work, but the timing I find pretty fascinating, because when you look at where we were 100 years ago when the American Civil Liberties Union was formed, there were a lot of parallels to what's going on today, aren't there, or weren't there?
Well, there were in a certain sense. I mean, and we're coming right out of World War I when the ACLU was formed, and that was the sort of the height of the A.M. Palmer raids, you know, the raids that the Justice Department basically put together to arrest thousands of Americans across the country who they accused of being anarchists, who they accused of being Bolshevists, for essentially speaking out against U.S. policy, or for joining the Communist Party, or for speaking out against various things that the government didn't like. But it also grew out of another very tumultuous sets of things. I mean, in 1919, you had what came to be known as Red Summer. There were vicious race riots across the country, essentially triggered by the desire of whites to prove the blacks that they did not have equality even after World War I. And there was a a massacre in Elaine, Arkansas. There were huge riots in Chicago and Washington, D.C., et cetera, all around that. And it was also a time of labor unrest. I mean, you had a huge steel strike, you had a coal strike, you had a police strike in Boston, you had a dock worker strike in Seattle. All of these big, big events were going on. And so America was sort of in turmoil, much more turmoil than it is now, actually. And there was this whole sense that something was guiding this, at least among the Democratic administration at the time, which was the Wilson administration, right. Which that, you know, this couldn't be happening just on its own. There had to be some malevolent force behind this, and they decided to focus on the anarchists, and then that's where the parallel comes in. I mean, in his executive order of a couple of weeks ago, Trump specifically mentioned anarchists, and he mentioned Antifa. I mean, he wants to make this into a war between people who are anti-United States and engaged in anarchy and people who want to maintain order and democracy. It's a false narrative, and it was a false narrative back 100 years ago, and ultimately it fell apart in part because 100 years ago, you had a very courageous public official in the Labor Department who stood up. I mean, because at that time, the deportations went through the Labor Department for reasons that aren't worth going into now. Okay. Yeah, but there was a Labor Department official, a guy named Lewis Freeland Post, who got all of these people that the Attorney General wanted to deport, basically because they had somehow been associated with leftist thought or somehow going to a Communist Party meeting or something. And he's going, wait a minute, they haven't violated any laws. Why are we deporting all of these people? Make a long story short, he ended up in hearings before the Congress where they looked into it. And sort of the high point of the hearing came at one point when Post was asked, okay, well, how dangerous is it? What's going on? And he replied, we have arrested tens of thousands of people. We crashed into their bedrooms at 2 o'clock in the morning. We dragged them into jail. Often we didn't tell them what they were being charged with. And at the end of the day, you know, even though the Justice Department said there were bombings planned, there was all this sabotage planned, all we found were, you know, three pistols and two of them were 22 caliber after all of those thousands of people were arrested. This is just crazy. And that was sort of the beginning of the realization among people that mattered, which is to say people who actually could control policy, that the Attorney General was out of control. And the Attorney General, who at that point was a primary candidate for the President of the United States, his candidacy, his campaign, his candidacy sort of just tanked. And most people to this day, if they know Alexander M. Palmer at all, they know him because he was this awful attorney general, you know, who tried to repress American thought. They certainly don't know him as someone who was a dazzling candidate for president of the United States. And what we have, so when you talk about parallels, what we have again is the executive branch trying to convince Americans that there is an anarchist revolution taking place when there isn't one. I mean, there are certainly people who have all kinds of thoughts, and I'm sure there are some people who believe in anarchy who have been associated with some of these protests, but that's a different matter. Mm-hmm. And the other point is that things like anarchy, things like communism, even though we didn't really recognize it 100 years ago, we now realize that's protected by the First Amendment.
Right.
I mean, those are speech issues. You know, you cannot be arrested, at least not legally arrested and convicted and tried, just for having thoughts about something, just for having views on something. And that was sort of where, and you didn't really ask this question, but I'll go here. I mean, that's sort of what gave the ACLU its life. It's sort of standing up and saying, wait a minute, you have, you know, thousands of people who have been arrested. Also, you know, during the war, there's this big union, IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, otherwise known as the Wobblies. Okay. You had the biggest trial ever in history, where you had 166 of them indicted by the Justice Department who were brought into a federal court in Chicago and tried it one time. And again, there were allegations they were planning to sabotage the war effort. They were planning to destroy ships. They were planning to do all kinds of things, according to the Justice Department, before they got to court. In court, they never brought up any of that. They never tried to establish any of that. They basically just try to connect these people to thoughts and to expressions of admiration for communism or the Bolshevik Revolution and things of that nature. And they got convicted. And there were years spent by the fledgling ACLU and other organizations trying to get these guys pardoned, trying to get them out of jail. So you had a real threat to civil liberties going on there. And I mean, most people who think about it at all say, well, wait a minute. Now, we're America. We had a Bill of Rights passed, you know, as the first set of amendments to the Constitution. They were ratified in 1791. What do you mean we had to protect free speech? We've always had free speech in this country. We've had that without exception, going back to the founding fathers. And technically, in the sense of it being written in amendments, that's true. There were amendments that said you had these rights. They were never really recognized. Whenever it was tossed them aside, they were tossed aside. And then the ACLU, there was a series of cases, helped to establish that. Two, this set of rights were not binding on the states. So these were only federal rights. And it was not until the 1920s, and again, with a series of cases, one in particular, which involved people from New York who had published a communist-affiliated newspaper, and they were charged with violating New York's anarchy and criminal syndication law by publishing a article.
Wow.
Which advocated some things that were considered to be revolutionary. Those guys got convicted, and that conviction actually stood for a long time. They ultimately got pardoned. But as part of that suit, when it went to the Supreme Court, the whole question came up. Well, wait a minute. This is a state law. The state can do whatever it wants, right? It can put you in prison for having thoughts that aren't right, right?
No.
And the Supreme Court basically said, well, look, you know, the Bill of Rights applies to the states. And that was something, and they basically created what was called the incorporation clause or principle, which is they incorporated the Bill of Rights into a binding responsibility of the states. So states then had to say, okay, we can't pass these laws either, which forbid you to think certain things or to say certain things.
So the ACLU, did it form as an organization to take on one specific cause, or was it to fight for the rights which we have in the Constitution but weren't necessarily being recognized in individual states and individual municipalities?
If you will indulge me, it's going to take a little while to explain it.
Okay, please.
because the ACLU, even though it was technically formed in 1920, did not just arise out of nothing. There were two predecessor organizations that led to the ACLU. One was called the AUAM, the American Union Against Militarism. That was formed in 1915. Why was the AUAM formed, and why? It was formed basically by a group of women who were suffragettes, who were opposed to war, who also obviously wanted the vote for women, and women didn't have the vote nationally at that time. And they said, okay, we need an organization. We need an organization because, you know, at that point, the war had already taken off in Europe. And they are saying, we don't want the United States involved in that. We don't want our guys involved in that. We need to stay out of that. And they formed an organization and it involved some of the highest profile women of the day. I mean, Jane Addams, who became famous for founding Hull House, was one of the people who was involved in that. And a number of other very prominent people. And they ultimately ended up headed by a woman called Crystal Eastman, who was a Ivy League graduate. She She was very accomplished. You know, had a law degree. You know, had, you know, lots of credentials. And for a couple of years, they fought to keep the United States out of war. Unfortunately, obviously, we got into the war in 1917, or fortunately, unfortunately, depending on what you think. They did keep us out of war with Mexico, but that's a whole other story. You know, once the war commenced, the whole question was, well, does this organization disband? What does it do? Well, what they immediately realized was that young men who were conscientious objectors, who considered themselves conscientious objectors, were being swept up and were having to, were being drafted and were being forced to, to become part of the army and to fight in the war. They also realized that the very act of speaking against the war, of speaking against the draft, mm-hmm. could put in prison. And so they said, wait a minute, let's form another organization. And they formed something called the National Civil Liberties Bureau. Okay. That was formed in 1917. And then the function of that organization was to stand up for the rights of people who were affected by this pro-war surge. And were being essentially thrown under the jail. I mean, one of the funny cases from that era, and funny in retrospect, I guess, was that a filmmaker made a movie called Spirit of 76, which he thought was a very patriotic movie. It was about the American Revolution and about getting freedom from the British king and about standing up for people's rights. Well, he got indicted for violating the Espionage Act. And essentially, why did he get indicted? He got indicted because she put the British in an unfavorable light. At that point, the Brits were an ally, and it was illegal, to put an ally as they interpreted the law, to put an ally in an unfavorable light.
Wow!
So he ends up being hauled into court and sentenced to 10 years in prison. He ultimately got pardoned, but that's the kind of that's the way that rights were regarded back then. So anyway, flash forward to 1920, the war is over. Okay. The National Civil Liberties Bureau is trying to decide, do they still have a mission? Should they just fade away? What should happen with them? At the same time, you have a guy named Roger Baldwin, mm-hmm. who is the founding executive director of the ACLU and also was director of the National Civil Liberties Bureau. Well, Roger Baldwin had been in jail. He had been in jail because he himself was a conscientious objector, and he refused to be drafted. So he had spent his time in jail. He was contemplating, and he finally got out, and he was contemplating, okay, so what do I do next? And he had various ideas, but there weren't really anything firm. The second of January, 1920, was one of the big Palmer raids. I mean, they took people out of New York, Chicago, California. I think they arrested thousands of people that day. That night, because these raids tended to happen in the middle of the night,
right?
And so this group came together and said, maybe there's a purpose for us here. With all that's going on, maybe we shouldn't just let this organization die. Maybe we should formally become more serious. And so it was at that point and a meeting that happened in the aftermath of the Palmer raids that they decided to form the ACLU, which was then the American Civil Liberties Union. So I'm sorry if this story has been too long.
No, that's okay. So I'm curious, though. Ellis Coase is with us, the author of the new book, Democracy, If We Can Keep It. Obviously, we all know, and we've heard it repeated a lot recently, the old... what do we have? Is it a republic or a monarchy? And I think it was Benjamin Franklin who said a republic if we can keep it. That's how the story goes. I don't know how true it is. So where does democracy, if we could keep it, come from?
Well, I think that even though we formally have a republic, we have a democratic republic. Yeah, so, mm-hmm. so, so, to think of it as a democracy, right. Even though it's not direct, even though in technical terms, it's not a direct democracy. And so the question that I think the ACLU and the civil liberties groups are facing now is how fragile is our democracy? How capable is it withstanding what seemed to many people to be assaults being made on it, particularly by the current administration? And is it strong enough? Is it committed enough to get through this, number one, and to preserve what we consider as our democracy, number two? And I think that's a big question that a lot of civil libertarians are facing, I think, including the ACLU. I mean, the minute that Trump was declared the winner of the election, the ACLU launched a review. They actually had done it before, but they launched a review of his public statements, of everything he has said, and concluded that he was going to be a walking constitutional disaster. And it took out a full-page ad, the morning after his election, basically saying, look, if you try to carry out the policies you say you want to carry out, which in our judgment are largely unconstitutional, we're going to be on the other side and we're going to oppose that. So it started off as, and it never done that before. Before a president even took office, said, look, on the basis of what you're saying, we think you are perhaps a danger to the Constitution and a danger to our democracy. So we're going to have to oppose a lot of what you're saying. So please don't try to do those things. and what we have seen, of course, beginning with the attempt to do the Muslim ban, going into the whole, separation of children at the border and putting them into cages, ultimately, and hiding what they had done, and then ultimately sort of acknowledging it until we get now where, you have peaceful protesters who have been tear gassed and pummeled, people who have been tossed into vans without clear reason. It looks a lot like some scary dictatorships superficially.
Yes, it does.
And people are saying, hey, wait a minute. Or have we been too comfortable in just assuming that nothing can threaten the most powerful democracy in the world? And I think what we're now beginning to realize is that even though many people voted for Trump as a protest and then because they didn't like Hillary or for any number of other reasons, thinking, well how much damage can this guy do? what we are realizing is that the presidency is an extremely powerful position, and that when you combine control of the entire executive branch, including the Justice Department, along with control of a political party, along with a guy who has no particular reason, no particular devotion to observing the rights, and doesn't in some occasions seem to know what he's permitted to do under the Constitution and what he isn't. And then you have something that a lot of people find very, very threatening.
As they should. So we're speaking with Ellis Coase. He's the author of the new book, Democracy If We Can Keep It, the ACLU's 100-Year Fight for Rights in America. And the book tells the stories of some of the biggest cases that the ACLU was involved in over the last 100 years, and everything from the Scopes trial to the Scottsboro Boys, to the internment of Japanese Americans. And those stories are also important because I truly believe that if we don't take heed of history, we are doomed to repeat it. And I think in many ways we are repeating these stories. But in addition to recounting the history of the last 100 years, you also include an examination of the state of civil liberties in the United States today. And I think faced with what you're just talking about and what we're dealing with right now, that's for the next, the 10 minutes we have left, that's what I'd like to concentrate on, because frankly, I'm afraid, and people that I talk to every day are really scared of this man who is occupying the Oval Office. I still have a hard time referring to him as president because everything about him is so reprehensible. And, I just played a clip where he talked about the protesters in Portland and he called them anarchists and rioters and people who hate America. Well, this country was founded on protest. And for the most part, the protesters have been peaceful protesters, but this administration relies on the concept of gaslighting, where they tell you one that, you know, the sky is green when you know for a fact it's blue, and they make you feel crazy after a while because you keep insisting it's blue and they're telling you it's green. Right?
Well, so, I think that's true, Nicole, but I think there's something else is also going on, and it's not new. I mean, there has long been a huge constituency for throwing civil rights and throwing civil liberties out the window whenever we feel threatened.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of what Trump is trying to do is trying to make people feel threatened by these people, trying to make
them
feel. And because if you look at some of the biggest abuses of civil liberties that have occurred. In fact, I think you probably without exception, if you look at these big abuses of civil liberties, if you talk about the internment of Japanese, which was clearly an awful and unconstitutional thing. You know, if you look at, you know, the Palmerism we were just talking about. If you look at what happened to civil rights workers in the 1950s and the 1960s who were being beat. Even if you go back before that and look to the Reconstruction era, which is where the Ku Klux Klan originated, the justification for the Ku Klux Klan is that they were getting control over all these terrible people who were trying to destroy America. You know, so that's always been a potent argument. And one of the things that Roger Baldwin said at one point when he was asked about what was the most important struggle he had been involved in. And he said something to the fact that, you know, the battle for civil liberties is never won. We're always refighting that battle, because whether it's an attack, you know, like the 9/11 attack, or whether it's an explosion, you know, of domestic violence in one way or another, there are always Americans, many of them, who say, forget civil liberties. We're in danger. Let's take care of it. Let's beat the hell out of these people. Let's send them out of the country. Let's do whatever we need to do to keep us safe. Trump may or may not know what's unconstitutional. He certainly has smart people who know. But they go along with him. And they go along with him because, one, he's the commander in chief. He can order whatever he wants to order. And people will follow that, and until someone stops them, and the someone who can stop them, you know, is usually the courts or the Congress, or some other or someone else in the executive branch. But no one in the executive branch seems to have the ability to stand up to him, including the Justice Department.
Right.
And so he's left to do whatever he feels like doing for a while, until, you know, the court orders come through, or until some other force intervenes somehow.
Right. And what's dangerous right now is, I mean, we've come to realize over the past year or so that the attorney general is every bit as, I don't know what the word, corrupt as Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump has for years talked about he wants his Roy Cohn. Well, he found his Roy Cohn. And they are, I mean, the attorney general would not say that the president doesn't have the right to move the presidential election. Now, I think Trump threw that out there yesterday to distract the media and the public from the horrific economic news we got yesterday, sure, where we had the biggest economic downturn, almost 30% or over 30% in the last quarter. And, you know, he likes to run on his great economy. I call it opposite world. Everything is the opposite of what it actually is. But the fact that the attorney general, who is supposed to be the people's attorney, is acting like he's, you know, the president's fixer, I find it as a constitutional crisis. Isn't this exactly what the ACLU should jump into? My biggest problem is there's no one coming to save us. And I'm wondering if the ACLU is the organization who can save us here.
Well, the ACLU has filed several lawsuits, and there are other lawsuits that are moving their way through the courts. You know, and there's a temporary restraining order now against certain of the practices that the federal cops were doing in Portland. So, yes, ultimately, someone will intervene in here. But I think what this whole era is going to cause us to think a lot about how we have structured our government.
Yeah.
And in point of fact, I mean, the Justice Department, and a lot of people don't know this, but the Justice Department, you know, came into existence during Reconstruction. It was its creation was to deal with a lot of the violence and that was happening when the South basically fought Reconstruction, and so their original suits were suits, you know, and connected to that set of issues. But it was also constructed, and then before that, there were private attorneys who were being hired to represent the government, and there were questions of whether they were charging too much. There's all this other stuff we don't really need to talk about right now, you know. But the result of that was we got a Justice Department. But the Justice Department, you know, reports to the president.
Yeah.
And even though it has a tradition of independence, it is not legally independent from the president. You know, so Bill Barr can be fired whenever the president wants to fire him. There's obviously no danger of that because he's that it works for him to try to do whatever this president wants him to do. So the whole idea that the Justice Department is truly independent is a bit of an illusion. Mm. I mean, it's had a tradition, and most presidents have respected that tradition, and they have allowed the Justice Department. I mean, Nixon obviously tried to step on it, and ultimately, yeah, it created a disaster for him. But even Nixon, for all of his flaws, basically represented lines and that shouldn't be crossed. And ultimately, he realized that making war on the Justice Department was a line too far. I don't think there are any lines that our current president recognizes that should not be crossed.
No.
And so he's suggesting that the election is going to be fraudulent. So what is he going to order the Justice Department to do? I mean, and he, you know, and what is he going to order the Postal Office to do if he believes that mail-in ballots are not legal ballots somehow? Yeah, those are questions that you would never have raised about another president, but that we are finding being raised about this president because he doesn't respect those boundaries. And when we have thought for so long that we are a nation of laws and mm-hmm. that we're protected by these laws, but what we're finding out is that a lot of these laws are not really laws. They are traditions. And there's nothing to stop a rogue president from tossing out traditions that don't suit him.
Right. And that's what we're seeing. I mean, one of the things that so frightens me and appalls me is anybody who doesn't agree with him, he labels un-American. They hate America. They're not, you know, they're evil. If you're not a Republican, if you're not a Trump loyalist, I mean, he's got somebody in his office vetting staffers to make sure they're sufficiently loyal. This is frightening and truly un-American.
Well, some of that is just politics, and some of that everybody does, but he does it at a level beyond what everybody does.
Yeah.
I mean, never been a president. I mean, inspectors generals throughout the government, their job is to be independent. Their job is to find wrongdoing.
Right.
I stand up to it in their various agencies. If they do something Trump doesn't like, he fires them. You know, we have never had this before. So the whole idea of this independence from the executive gets thrown out the window under a president like this. And as I said, what is really driving home is that we have given presidents a lot more power than they probably ought to have in certain areas.
Right.
And the question sort of becomes, okay, if we ever get out of this particular set of situation that we're in right now, how do we deal with that? And I think that's going to be one of the huge questions for the future as we figure out how to regain and restructure our democracy in this country.
Most definitely. And I think this subject matter kind of segues nicely into the book that you have coming out in September called The Short Life and Curious Death of Free Speech in America, because I think we're dangerously close. So I look forward to seeing that. Ellis Coase, this book that we're talking about is Democracy If We Can Keep It, the ACLU's 100-Year Fight for Rights in America. Again, the history is so important. But I think we are in a chapter that's still being written that might be the most dangerous one. Certainly it feels dangerous to me because we're living through it. But there are many of us who fear whether or not we can keep it if we're going to come out of this in one piece. And I guess
absolutely,
we'll find out in the next 6 months or so, won't we?
We will. Cole, and I look forward to chatting with you again at some point.
I hope so. I look forward to reading your new book as well. So people can find you at elliscoast.com. I will put links to both on my blog at NicoleSandler.com. Thank you so much for your time today. It was a pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to reading through all the stories in this book and your next one.
Wonderful. You take good care.
You too. Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Okay. And there you have it with the ACLU. They're so important, and I don't know. Right now, I feel like they're the ones that can save us. I don't know if anyone can, except us, November 3rd. All right. With that, we're done for the week. Thank you for listening. I will see you back here Monday for Music Monday with Kevin Montgomery and the rest of the news and all that. Have a great weekend, everyone. Bye.